This is John Costa on Spotlight on Heritage with Rob Watson. How are you, Rob?
I'm very well, thank you, John.
Cool. And as our tradition always goes, we mention the weather, but we've actually got good weather to talk
about. It's noteworthy, isn't it? It's going to be 26, 27 today, and then in the rest of the week. So by the time you hear this, you've probably got a bit fed up with it being 30 degrees, we hope.
Yeah, and hope everybody made it from when we recorded it.
Nobody's melted.
Everybody listened to it, so that's great. So this week on Spotlight on Heritage, we've got a special guest, and my special guest and Rob's special guest is Nick LaBand. Nick, thanks
Hello,
for joining us.
Hello, John. Hello, Rob.
Cool. Welcome. Welcome to Spotlight on Heritage. Now, Nick, I've known you for a while now, and we first connected through your interest in military history through your project called Trench, which was about digital mapping people from World War One. And we've since gone on and discovered a mutual interest in not only military history, but sort of, you know, social history as well. So 1901, 1921 is your kind of specialist area in Leicester.
It's very much an interest of mine, yeah. It's the people.
And how did you first get into it? This is what I really want to know. It's less about the project with these kind of conversations that Rob and I have. And again, it's not a Watson guide. It's like, how did you first become interested in that? So.
Well, like most people, we have a bit of an interest in history, but we don't take it anywhere, do we? My interest in the First World War and social history came about in the centenary of the start of the First World War back in 2014. Numerous years before that, I've been given the service medals of both my grandfathers and my father. I became custodian for the family for them. But as everybody, we can just put them in a box and forget about them. Well, in 2014, on the centenary, I got them out and displayed them, and the lights go out. So we set a light up for it on the day, the 4th of August. But when I was handling the medals, when you look at them and you think they're just bits of metal with fancy ribbon on it, but what are they really about? And it was from that day that I really went out and tried to discover what my grandfathers did in the First World War. Subsequently, I found more about one than the other, simply through what's available in archives and things like that. But in my head, the project that's developed since 2014, it's like eccentric circles. I look at one grandfather or the other grandfather, and you can look at his story, but you can go on and you think, well, what did he do in the First World War? Well, he served in the 4th Battalion Leicestershire Regiment. So you then have a story about that as well.
Yeah, so where was the battalion? What were they
exactly
doing and that kind of thing?
As a career, before I was made redundant from that, I was 15 years or more in digital mapping. So I was having my head, well, if my grandfather went here and he had joined the 4th Battalion and he went to France, what was his path through that? When did he join the 4th Battalion and what was their path? When did my grandfather leave the 4th Battalion when he got wounded and came back to the UK? The 4th Battalion obviously went on and continued throughout the war in France. So their story continues, but my grandfather's story went in a different path. But yeah, that's the First World War. A huge interest for that, and you can obviously, many people do fall down rabbit holes of.
Well, this seems to be our, you know, Rob and I, when we interviewed Sue Lester a couple of months ago now from the Leicester Rutland Family History Society, it was very much around going down the rabbit hole. You kind of, you know, what time do you have to do stuff? And also, the thing is, it can be quite costly as well, trying to sign up to like Find My Past or Ancestry and all these kind of stuff.
You make a point there. Yes, we do. We can spend a lot of money from it. But my father, back in the 80s, was looking into the family history. And of course, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have all this stuff that was readily available to us. My dad did it the old-fashioned way. He went to the archive, he went to the parish churches, he went to wherever, Somerset House as it was at the time for the archives. So he spent a lot of money on train fares or dragging family members around to get somewhere. And we've still got his archive of that research, and it's all paper, of course, and it's a big, huge pile of it.
So have you expanded on that and included like a digital element as well, what you've been able to find?
My dad went through a process of looking into... he was a person who wanted to see how far he could get back. But with a name like La Bande, it could come down from any avenue. Huguenot, for example, persecution of Huguenots in Europe at the time. And they came over to this country and settled and whatever. But modern thought in the family is it potentially could have come from Germany, the name. But my dad's idea was to go back as far as possible. Mine isn't that. My head in the rabbit hole is too much within, as you mentioned earlier, the 1901, 1921 social period. Now, moving forward on that, it's that period because it fits in with the census. 1901 census, 1911 census, and now we have available the 1921 census, which is a brilliant piece of documentation if you look at the fact that it gives you other information.
So, Nick, a lot of people will talk to each other about like family history and look at photos and stuff like that. And you mentioned something just before when we were talking about the census and stuff, and you know, where did these things come from, and you know, why people got involved in them and stuff like that. So, you've got three census periods that you're interested in for social history, when it wrapping around your military history idea: 1901, 1911, and 1921. What were the changes at that time, would you say, in society that are demonstrated by those three censuses? Obviously, you've got new decade, end of the first decade from the turn of the century, and then you've got, you know, the one that's just after the war, a major piece of history.
Firstly, I picked that period of time simply because if you look at the First World War, the people who served with it or the families that were involved in, and it's people not just who served, but it's people who lived in society. So the census records are a good place to look at. And that period, people that came, were born and lived and whatever subsequently served. So that's why I use those censuses. But if you look at the turn of the century, we've just come out of the South African War. And I don't know how people were treated then, but I'm assuming there's a lot of unemployment from that and that sort of thing. But in 1901, we would have had a snapshot of what people were doing, where they were living. The detail in that census is slightly different to what you get in the 1911 census.
Because they change all the time, don't they? Evolve. Yeah, people don't realise that. It's not the same things all the time. It constantly evolves.
It may be nice if we had all this magic information, but no, you're right, it does change. For example, I'm quite... Because I've done a career in digital mapping, my poor little brain looks at things spatially. So if I see something... and for example, I've got a collector of Roll of Honour as part of my trench collection. It's part of my trench project. But if I look at any one of my pieces of Roll of Honour, I can spatially reference them on a map. And this comes from my digital mapping days. And the same with the census. It's a census of people in the United Kingdom of that point in time.
So where they lived, where they worked, what they did,
exactly.
And that kind of stuff. It's an understanding of a community, yeah, in a slightly different way. And I think this is where, I mean, last year at my Military History Live event, you came with some, you know, digital maps that you'd created of different places. And it said about, you know, people that worked at this location, this is where they lived. And then, you know, if they were in this battalion, this is where they served. And it's starting to match up things with people that you suddenly realise at the beginning of the war, everybody was from Leicester in the Leicestershire Regiment. And
yeah,
then as the war went on, people started coming from all over the country because they were replacements for
And they're different
casualties.
Stories that are very fluid. They change all the time. And it's gaining an understanding of how they change. You know, yeah, you just said up there about generally the people in the Leicestershire Regiment may have been... living or born in Leicester, the two regular battalions, the 1st and 2nd, probably most of them were Leicester or Leicestershire based. The territorials, most certainly from Leicestershire. There's two of those, 4th and 5th battalions, of which I've mentioned already. My grandfather, he was in the 4th battalion, which was a city one, the 5th battalion being the county one, territorial. Yeah, they would potentially have all come from Leicester, and they would have worked in places.
I mean, like gents and corers and all the kind of places that people would still know now the names, because they were big employers at the time.
Yeah, again, now you've mentioned it, I'd like to mention a couple of the companies I'm interested in at this point in time. There's one, the British United Shoe Manufacturing Company, which was based on Belgrave Road. Now, I haven't got that in my role of honour. That's actually held at a project called At Risk War Memorials Project for Leicestershire.
So Dennis and Robin and Chris.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. They've got it in their collection there and keeping it safe. I got interested in that because I was researching a friend's name, and with a magnifying glass I looked at this from a picture. It wasn't a very good quality picture, but I saw a name and thought it was him, and I went to my friend, oh, it's on a war memorial. But that's how I got interested in that. But now, because of my mapping, I'm trying to see how I can, out of the 350 names on that list who we know worked at the British United Shoe Manufacturing Company, potentially most of those lived very near to where they worked. So I've been looking at the Belgrave Ward and the Latimer Ward, and I've digitally been plotting the building parcels, let's say, and assigning a census schedule, for example, so we know where those people live.
So Nick, probably for the first time, I really wish that we were live streaming this, because as you started talking about housing parcels and that, you completely changed. you went super geek and suddenly you disappeared down this rabbit hole of why you like doing digital mapping. And that's why I love talking to you, because about this subject. But it's that where people lived and where they, you know, how far people went to work. You know, Leicester was one of those places because of all the sort of terraced housing and the big employers, where suddenly like social clubs became a thing. You could move as a single person to Leicester and actually find a community, not only that you worked with, but you socialised with, and you did sport, and you did, like, you know, went to the social club. And we kind of forget about that part of the city. We kind of remember who the employers were, but we forget about the fact that it was made up of all of these people that were working.
It's huge interest to me. My grandfather, my dad's dad, he lived on Filbert Street. And just by saying Filbert Street, many people will know what I'm about to say. It was the key place for Leicester football, Leicester Foss at the time, I think it was. Leicester City Football, as it is known now. Who played the football? Where did they go? Derby, Nottingham, I don't know. But these are all more stories for the people of Leicester. Did the community of Leicester go and travel up to Derby to see them play, etc., etc.? There's rugby, so there's sporting events. There's other aspects of society like policing, fire. I haven't got anything in my Roll of Honours trench collection for the police, but I know there's a couple of good stuff at the police archive at St John's. I'm going to look at that soon.
I guess also I think we forget, don't we, that with World War One, it was about, like, you know, people may or may not know about the POWs battalion, so like large groups of people that signed up that were working together or whatever, and they all went off as one battalion called the famous POWs battalions. But of course you're talking about POWs battalions. Well, what did people do that from the Leicester football? Did people do that from the rugby? Did people do that from the NHS or the hospitals then? Did people do it from the police? We forget about, like, these people served as well.
I'm sure they did. The actual detailed history, I'm not an expert, but yes, there are, like, sporting battalions and stockbrokers battalions and stuff like that, which developed at some point through the war. So there were groups of people that did that, and the POWs battalions are very famous. A number that are quite famous. I don't know who the first battalion said, oh, we're POWs battalions. But Bradford POWs, for example, comes to mind. I think there's ones that name themselves POWs in Liverpool and Manchester. I'm sure there's many people who joined up in Leicester who joined up as a group. but I'm not sure they were generally called POWs battalions. I'm associating the POWs idea with the service armies, of course, which were developed at the beginning of the First World War. And they did go in groups.
That kind of, it's one of the probably only conflicts before or since, actually, where groups of people were like, well, actually, just go off, and particularly because they all thought it was going to be over by Christmas. They were like, let's go off, it'll be jolly japes, and then we'll all be back for tea and buns by Christmas.
Yeah, it's, why did they do it? My grandfather was a young man. I say lied about his age, because...
Was creative with the truth.
It was very creative with the truth, yeah. We know a lot of boys did sneak in at like 14, 15, 16.
Particularly if you were like 5'11", you could get away with it, couldn't you?
Yeah. But my grandfather really didn't need to. He was... how old was he? He was 18. So why did he lie about his age? Well, I've been to the records office in Wigston, and I've read papers. There was an article in the paper, Leicester Mercury of the time. I think it was dated something like the 23rd of August. Now, it was the commanding officer of the 4th Battalion, Leicestershire Regiment. Now, they'd already moved to Luton for training and that sort of stuff, but the commanding officer came back to Leicester to the drill hall at the magazine. Well, the drill hall there near the magazine. And he was reported to say, look, we need more people to fill our spot. They couldn't go anywhere until they had a full complement of men and a second line, et cetera, et cetera. So he was desperate to get these men in and then get off to France and do the business. So he reported that he needed about 250 men. But he stated they needed to be between the ages of, I think it was something like 20 and 25, something like that. Well, my grandfather was only 18, so I can see my grandfather reading this report in the paper and going, I'm having a bit of that.
And I think also because it was meant to be over by Christmas, there's that
I'm going to miss it, yeah, yeah.
So you're listening to John Coster on the Spotlight on Heritage podcast with Rob Watson and our special guest, Nick LeBand, who's talking about all things to do with World War One, trench, digital mapping, the censuses from 1901 to 1921. Fascinating stuff. I love it. It's learning about your city. Rob, do you think there's people doing this kind of thing in Liverpool? There must be. All this stuff must have come out during the centenary.
Probably. The thing that strikes me is the size of the city at that time. So it was prior to, what's the name of the road, where the, if you go down Narborough Road and you get to the point where the council housing was built, the biggest estates there. Just kind of you keep going that way, so as you go outwards.
Boston Lane, sure.
Yeah, so that wasn't there.
The Jaguar Garage.
Yeah, so it's so prior to that, you know, you got to Westcote, and that was the edge and the boundary of the city.
For that part, pretty much. Being a mapping person, I look at old maps all the time, and you're right. The development there onwards came after. A lot of development in the 20s, of course, for all cities around the country. People coming back from war, families were developing. They needed to move places. Slums all over the country. I'm not suggesting Leicester had the worst slums, but we certainly had them. And a new era after the First World War, we wanted development and places to put people. Braunston is one area which I think was developed in around 1926. You look at old maps for the First World War period, of course, it's not there. Subsequent maps will show it. But, I love
it. It's interesting when you go up to Leicester Museum and Art Gallery on New Walk now, they're going to the shops for Saffron Lane, which is just up the top of where I live, actually. A few of those shops are still there. It's quite interesting. But it's talking about... Saffron Lane and those areas around the Pork Pie Library was the houses fit for heroes that were built after World War One. So we've got this. One of the things I was talking to someone in the museum actually was, if you pay first a very close attention during the first episode of Peaky Blinders, so like, you know, episode one, series one, one of the things that the main character, Tommy Shelby, talks about is the reason that they are a criminal outfit, obviously, which the Peaky Blinders are, based on real characters that existed, is the fact that they came back from World War One to this house fit, this is a land fit for heroes, and there was going to be jobs and all that, and discovered that none of this existed, as many men have done, and women now, I should imagine, returning from conflict back to look, being looked after as veterans, and suddenly that support's not there. And that whole Peaky Blinders story come from, well, actually, we're just going to take it for ourselves because we're not going to be given it, and hence their hatred for officers and the cavalry and stuff. And the thing is, when you look at popular culture like that, knowing that and then looking at an exhibition like that, Land Fit for Heroes, about how these things happened, you can understand why people are always upset. And it fits really well with the other week we had our launch of the Leicester Unemployed March 1905 project, where 400 men marched to London to see the King and the Archbishop of Canterbury, all of whom refused to see them, talking about the plight of men being unemployed and no work. Well, of course, the reason a lot of them were unemployed was they were wounded or retired servicemen that had fought in the South African wars, but then many of them had been working in the factories that were at full pelt making boots and jumpers, sweaters for the military. So actually war fighting is inextricably linked with employment and wages, and a lot of people didn't want to go because they were earning good money. And so all of these things are all kind of linked. Are you finding that when you do your connections between employability and people joining up and where they live, that there's this connection between war's good for business and full employment?
I can't say I've delved into that particularly much, but of course I do know that because of war, people get moved about. There's, you know, hundreds of thousands of men moving, which may have an impact on where their family live. There's money coming in because now the soldier who's serving is getting a bit of money. Many organisations actually paid an extra bit for the family to help while he was away, to help for the family situation. But inevitably,
I never knew that.
Yeah, my mind is a bit of a bag of a lot of information I've read from somewhere.
Nick said, "Don't quote me," but I think people
don't
did
quote.
This.
I've read it numerous times that organisations. I'll tell you where I would have read it. All my Roll of Honour, I've got plenty of them. They've come from varying sources, and quite a lot of them come from an organisation. So the organisation Roll of Honour, either done during or after the war, and they'll have a little synopsis at the beginning, and they'll tell you that they're looking after their workforce.
So, Nick, how do you start a project like this? Does someone come to you with a commission, or tell me about the At-Risk War Memorials project that you did, because it came to you with a specific need.
There's a couple of things I did for the At-Risk War Memorials project. One I did off my own back, and the other one I did because I heard them talking about it, I think. I've already talked about the British United Shoe Manufacturing Company. That Roll of Honour I've always been interested in for a while. But I also did a map for them to show where the locations of the time where their memorials were. We know from that At-Risk War Memorials project is they don't always find the Roll of Honour in the original position. I know they've found some in skips, for example. So I mapped all I'm not sure how many they had, how many they've got in their collection, but I mapped all the locations of that for them. Another map I did for them was they've got a Roll of Honour which comes from a postcard. So you imagine the size of a postcard. On it, at the time, they'd photographed a Roll of Honour, a physical memorial, which doesn't exist now, it's gone. It was there in some building somewhere for many years, but we forget about these things and it subsequently goes. But the postcard is a surviving record, albeit a ephemera, something that we don't necessarily keep forever. It's not intended to be kept, but they do exist. I've got plenty of postcards with that one. But the project I did with the At-Risk War Memorials, it was for the Dyers and Scourers Association of Leicester, which happened to be based on Rutland Street.
which we're recording this podcast
which
today.
Where we are today. If you look on a map, it's a triangular shape building opposite to where we are now. So that's was the headquarters. But of course, it's an association, so they've got numerous companies that are members of the association. It includes Corus, I think we mentioned that earlier. I think there's 15 on the list. But you can imagine a postcard size. How do I get the information on it? It's a real photo postcard, so they develop the photo straight onto the card. So you can get a magnifying glass where you can scan it to quite detail and zoom in, and you get all the names. So from that postcard, we can see the company names and the names of the people. So the interesting thing is, you know, those people work for that company in that area. I happened to take the 15 organisations from the association and mapped them. And being a dyer and scourers association, they're pretty much where you'd expect them to be, along the river and canal. Corus is the top end of the bend of the water there, next to the
And again, it's reaffirming where some of these places were, but how long they'd been there and the role that they were playing at that time in the city.
Yeah, indeed. As far as I understand it, Leicester was quite large in boot, but also dyeing and that sort of stuff. We've got a river, you know, what are you going to put on the river? Woolen dyeing and
cotton dyeing, whatever. Stuff,
yeah. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Talk about organisations. A spark just went in my head there. Because we look at the social period, 20 years of people, we want to know where they lived. A spark came into my head. Where do we find that information from? Where did people work? There's a beautiful record of books, an archive of books, trade directories. Absolutely fantastic. They come in all sizes, all cities, all whatever. But it tells you where the organisations were. It gives you the street. It tells you who, you know, a list of names of people who might have lived or worked within a company. But it would list people. I've actually found, I've talked about my grandfather a lot, my dad's dad, I've got a lot of information on him, but his name or his family name from Filbert Street appears in the trade directories through numerous years of that directory. So, yeah, if you're researching your family or you want to know where an organisation was because you used to work X, Y and Z place, trade directory, brilliant.
And this is what Sue was saying to us, Rob, wasn't it, about like looking sort of to your left and your right. Stop thinking in a linear way. Start looking at other things that you can have, like photos and pictures and things like that. So Nick, for our final section, I want to talk about a project that we're hoping to work on and collaborate on together, which is World War II at 90, because obviously it's 2025 now, and then in 4 years' time, 2029, it's going to be 90 years since World War II started. And, you know, when you mentioned 2014 earlier, 2014-2018 commemoration of World War I, and of course, the work that I was doing around that started in sort of 2011, 2012, thinking about what we were going to do and all the projects we ran in schools and stuff. So we really need to be thinking about that in 4 years' time now. I know that's after your time period, but, you know, all the records from 1931 census, the personal records, have gone. They got lost in a fire in 1942. So actually, a lot about people that were probably on that 1939 roll ready to fight in the war in World War II and who was ready to go and what age they were. 1921 really was the last time that we'd have had an individual record for that person.
Indeed, yeah. And a matter of fact with the 1921 census is it tells you where they worked, which is a big thing for me. Anyway, World War II. For me, yes, World War I is my forte. It's what I like, and it's the rabbit hole I like to jump down very often. My social period is 1901, 1921. But we are talking about people. We are talking about their stories. And
people that are still around and of that age as well, that maybe not, have not told their story to their family necessarily.
The people I'm looking at, their stories don't begin or start at that point in time. That period of time is just for me to get a base idea through a mapping project or a social history project, community project or whatever. This is the baseline. This is where we start. What are people doing at the turn of the century? Going on to Second World War, there is a connection. Again, my grandfather served. He was 18. We discussed he may or may not have fibbed about his age for one reason or another. But he had his son in 1922. So the maths isn't difficult. In 1940, he was 18. And he was old enough to go and serve. So you look at the 1939 register, which, as you say, was it wasn't a census, but it was for the war offices and the government to understand where people were, where the manpower was, etc., where we're going to get people to do X, Y, and Z. And so it's a brilliant document, 1939, and it's that link, it's that social family link between my grandfather, who served in the First World War, and his son, who subsequently served in the Second World War. So, yeah, my social period happens to be 01-21. But my project is always a baseline, which is mapping. There's your map. How do we tell those stories on that map? If I could ever get that baseline project and we get a functionality that allows people to tell their stories on it, does it really matter if it's the First World War or the social period, or can we have the same functionality to add those stories for the Second World War? I've not delved into my father's records. I know a bit about it because he mentioned it. At some point, I'll have a look into his service records.
And there are items that managed to survive as well, don't they? I mean, a lot of the stuff that I've got, I think we've got like 10 people that served in World War II on my family's history project, and then I think there's like 6 or 7 in World War One.
Have you seen the service records for all of those?
Yeah, they're all working my way through that. Yeah, and brilliant. Of course, the interesting thing about your period is that in 1901, if you were on that census and you were a baby, you were old enough to fight in World War One. And if you survived to be on the 1921 census, you were actually still eligible to serve in World War Two, even if it wasn't necessarily actively. You could serve, like my mum's grandfather served in the anti-aircraft thing, you know, because he was too old to go overseas, but he was serving and there was the home front. So those period of times are really interesting. It's been fascinating talking to you. How many hours a day do you lose down a rabbit hole, your final thing?
I can spend hours and hours.
Thank you for remembering to come here.
You're very lucky, because my brain would be, I've got to keep track of it. I'm one for jumping into a small project and I don't always finish it. It's the switches in my poor little brain. I'm so like excited and, oh, I've got to do this, and I'll get a new roll of honour. I've got one today in the post and I'm just going to go home, look at it, do something with it.
But, and then disappear down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, I'll see a name that's interesting, I'll go down that rabbit hole, but at the end of the day, I don't always finish it, what I wanted to do. I've got many roles of honour from the First World War that I've started to map. I need to finish them, I need the help to finish them.
Cool, excellent. Nick, thanks very much for taking the time to speak to us today.
John, thank you very much, and Rob, thank you.